Sheldon Evans, born on June 21, 1918, served in World War II in the U.S. Army. His highest rank is First Sergeant. This interview is taking place on May 22, 2013 in Mamaroneck, New York. Interviewed by Jesse Kling, assisted by Jan Northrup. This interview is being conducted for the Veterans History Project of the Library of Congress. Okay, so now our opening questions. What did your parents do for a living?
My dad was a banker. He was the assistant cashier of the Second National Bank in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. We lived in Forty Fort, which is about 2.5 miles from Wilkes-Barre across the Susquehanna River. My mother was not working at any time except taking care of the home, the house, and doing a great deal of work for the church, and particularly in the Sunday school. For more than 40 years, she was the beginner's class representative and teacher and encourager and understander of all people. She is very unusual in that respect. But she did not need to work, and she took care of the household. I had one sister who was 2 years older, but there were only two kids to take care of. But at times, or for a long while, we had chicken coops out in the backyard. And so she did get the job, which was shared with me, of taking eggs and so on, packing them. And so she did sell eggs and that kind of thing. But that was unusual.
Right? So did you have siblings?
Yes, one sister, 2 years older.
And what were you doing before you joined the Army?
Well, I had just finished college a year ago, and I got a job in the bank in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, not my dad's bank, the Second National, but I got a job in the First National and worked for them from just after I graduated. That would have been June through the following February, really, which was about the time I was drafted. Right.
And do you have any other family members who served in the military?
Yes, my father in World War I, and two uncles in World War I. My dad was a captain, and so was one of my uncles, and the other was a lieutenant. He was in the Air Force. The Air Force was just beginning to operate in those days. That was still World War I.
Were there others in World War II?
Family members, mm-hmm. Cousins, yes. I'd have them. One cousin who was about 2 years older than I am was in the Army a good deal longer, and he was not drafted. He joined, but well in advance of when I went into the service.
Mm-hmm.
No one else who was close, I think. Most of them, my other cousins, were much younger, weren't eligible. I did have one who entered the Navy about mid-war, I guess. Yeah, I forgot about that. And he was over in the Japanese Pacific area, and in his work, yeah. I think a submarine, if I'm not mistaken.
And you went into the Army in 1940, you said, right?
Yeah.
So, did you, at that time, did you see
well,
war?
Well, it was really 41 by that time. See, this was 1940. All the other things.
Mm-hmm.
The where I was fined. That was March 26, 1941. So that's when I actually entered the Army.
So that was still before Pearl Harbor.
Yes, yes. Six months, eight months, I guess, before.
Did you, at the time, do you think you saw war looming ahead? U.S. involvement in the war?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. There was no doubt about it. I didn't know about Pearl Harbor that that was going to happen, or that it would be against the Japanese, but we knew it would be against the Germans. There was no doubt in the world about that at that time.
So do you think you would have supported the prospect of the U.S. going to war at that time?
Yes, absolutely.
And what did other people think about that? Do you think other people you knew also thought that the U.S. should go to war? Was there some disagreement?
I think some, yes. But I think more and more people were realizing that in order to help England and France, Belgium, and all the others, that we needed to do something. They weren't able to handle it all themselves. So I think that was the general feeling of most people, that we would have to be there to fight.
What was military life like before Pearl Harbor?
A lot more casual than it was later. Pearl Harbor turned it into a serious activity very early on that Sunday. And at that time, I was in Fort Knox, Kentucky. I had a two-day pass for Saturday and Sunday, went into the city, Louisville. And went to church in the morning, stayed at the YMCA, went into church, and then a family invited me to dinner that day. And that was a common thing for soldiers to have that happen, many. And so I was very fortunate, went home with that family, and they had two boys, and just about finished dinner, as I recall it, and one of them got up and went over to the radio and turned it on. And there they were saying, all troops report to Fort Knox. The war has started. It was that kind of thing. Now, it's just after that happened. So in a hurry, everybody went. They had trucks and buses and everything under the sun to get everybody back to Fort Knox, where I was by that time. But I'll tell you about how I got there. But at any rate, that was later.
So how do you think life changed, military life changed, once the U.S. became part of the war?
Then it was really serious. We knew there was no fooling around then. When we first were taken in, I think, maybe we'll leave after a year, you know. Nobody knew exactly what was going to happen, I'm sure. But I think many said, oh, I'll be here a year, then go back to work and so on. It just wasn't going to happen that way. And that was the day that solved that work, where you had any other feelings.
Mm-hmm. And what was your reaction?
Well, I felt like every other one. We were told to get back to camp, and so we did. There was no doubt about it. But we knew then that was it. Any idea of getting finished after a year and so on was, and I had already, what would it be, about 8 months or something of that sort, but not quite that, really. More like 5 months, I think, total.
So what do you think what was your experience like training in military bases in the U.S.?
well, when I went in, I was immediately sent to what was then called Pine Camp in northern New York. And I was coming from Pennsylvania. And when I got there with a small group of people, we learned that it was the beginning of the 4th Armored Division, that the armored divisions were felt at that point to be extremely important, and they were the tank operations, and had the power and the weapons and so on, and the personnel to do the job. And I was glad that it was an armored division, but I didn't know then that it was expanding so rapidly. And when we arrived there, Pine Camp was almost just an open space. They had some barracks that had been constructed, but we were told if we were going to stand guard, they didn't have any weapons for us. You just get yourself a stick or something, make believe it's a rifle, that kind of thing. But at any rate, they were just establishing the armored force, so they had by that time number 4. And then as I went on, as I'll tell you, I got to the others as well. But we were the first group that really arrived there after the whole activity was set in motion. There weren't many people there at all, but we found out that very quickly that they were expanding, and people began to pour in from all over places. And they were still building some of the barracks and that kind of thing. As I recall it, I think some tents were used for a while and so on, as they were in other places. But it gradually expanded. Yeah. And go ahead.
Do you think your training was comprehensive and adequate at this time?
It was just beginning. Yeah, they had a small group of people there. But it's kind of interesting that I think it was an advantage for those of us who were arriving. For example, just after the second or third day there, one of the soldiers who had been there previously was giving us drill lessons and that kind of thing. And he suddenly stopped because the person came over from headquarters, and they asked if anybody knew anything about being able to arrange things for drills and ceremonies and so on. And they wanted somebody who had maybe done some library work at one time or another. And I had in high school, so I held up my hand. They said, okay, go on over to the headquarters and they'll tell you what they want you to do. And so got there, and they wanted to sort out a lot of these drill and ceremony kind of publications. And so I was put at that job for a while. And I got acquainted with it, and I did it pretty quickly and worked over lunchtime, that kind of thing, for a couple of days and in the evening. And then I found out that they wanted me to do more of that kind of work for other companies, because they were getting the same shipments and so on. Maybe they didn't have anybody who knew what to do with it. And so I was given that, and it got me acquainted with the work of the first sergeant and the headquarters and so on, and gave me an advantage for future as far as that was concerned. So I think other people did similar kinds of things, and in learning what the experienced soldiers were working on helped a great deal in the future. Right?
So when were you deployed out to Europe?
I really have to give you an awful lot of other material in the meantime, if you don't mean, if you don't mind that, because I didn't stay at Pine Camp very long. I was there until about August, and then they put me with a group that was going to go to Fort Knox, and we went in September, and there they were forming the 5th Armored Division. And so I got in on the start of that, and I'd done some other things. So they promoted me from private to sergeant, and I was put in charge of the distribution of uniforms and that kind of thing, in keeping records and so on of all things that came in, went out, that kind of thing. And that was a good deal of experience. And it wasn't long that I'd been there in Fort Knox that Pearl Harbor came along. And then after that, just a couple of months, and then the whole 5th Armored Division moved to Camp Cook, California. It was a new California summer part of the state, and it was an amazing thing to, by railroad, to move the entire 5th Armored Division, which then had about 20,000 men by that time, all the way to the West Coast and so on. And I wasn't there very long before they had me in a cadre to go to from there to back to Fort Knox, and that was where I became a first sergeant then, because I thought that my experience in several things, getting accustomed to them and so on, that I could move up to first sergeant. So that was where I stayed. And, there were other things in between. We moved several different places. We went, a small group went up to Camp Perry, Ohio, where there was a shooting range that was had been there a long while, and we took a lot of people there to sharpen their shooting and also to prepare for repairing and keeping operating the rifles and so on. So, but that was a temporary thing. Then I went back to Fort Benning, Georgia, and there joined the 10th Armored Division. We're already up to from 5 to 10 by then. So they were expanding all over the country. And the 10th Armored Division was the one I knew later when we were over in Europe. And let's see.
In your notes, Sheldon, I noticed that you said Fort Benning, Georgia had tremendous training.
Yeah.
Is that true, that the training at Fort Benning was better than the other places that you were?
It seems so to me, but we had our full company of men, and by that time we were sending people to, like, Aberdeen, Maryland for training and so on. So a lot of it was away from the campus, you might say, the place where the unit is operating. You know? And so there was a good deal of that in those days as well. But yes, that was the best of the others. I left the others and with the cadre, and cadre is means, actually it's a French word for framework, a nucleus or core group of trained personnel able to assume control and to train others. And that's what we were doing each time we moved from one to the other, or took them to Camp Perry, Ohio, or wherever it might be. It was a matter of training in that respect for those people. But over that time, particularly when I was a first sergeant, we had literally hundreds of men going to other training in other places, particularly, as I said, Aberdeen, Maryland. That was the heart of the training in weapons, primarily. So the guys would come back and know everything. They could blindfold it and put the weapons together and take them apart and so on. But that was great. But, so anyway, after that, then, developed the possibility of a specific training for a number of months, and it was entirely for people who had finished college, who had had psychological work at any time, and we're going to train people as they were coming from the areas where they were working where they were really in battle, that kind of thing. Taking them out of that and then training them for other kinds of things. And though we studied there, it started at the University of Alabama, and then went up to University of Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, and then out to the University of Iowa. And so in all three of those, we had some kinds of training, stayed longest at Iowa. And so we thought that by the time we were going overseas then, we would be following the battles and removing the people who needed help, the wounded, and those who were psychologically almost destroyed, that kind of thing, and to build them up again and reassign them a different way. Actually, it never really worked that way, I think, because everything happened so fast later. But at any rate, from that experience in Iowa, I was assigned to go overseas, no longer in any unit within the states. And that was when we went to Fort Slocum.
David's Island.
That I had never heard of Fort Slocum before. But they said during World War I, it was the largest recruiting depot east of the Mississippi, located just off De Rochelle and David's Island. But I'm not sure that they don't mean that that was in World War II, but I think it was in both, probably. But at any rate, it was where we went out. We were put off at the station in De Rochelle, and then pretty soon we arrived in Devil's Island, David's Island, rather. And then from there, within about 3 or 4 days, we were taken by boat down to the Hudson, and were put aboard the Aquitania, which was the sister of the Lusitania, which had been sunk. But a tremendous, tremendous ship. I think that it carried something like 10,000 soldiers, right. Something like that. Huge, huge thing. And we shot from there, jagged all the way to Scotland. And that was where we hit the English. Now, this was, I think, when we got to that spot, didn't we, on what happened when we went overseas. Mm-hmm. Was that your question?
But you were in armored division still, right?
No.
You weren't?
No, not at that point. No.
So what were you doing?
Not in any. We had our independence.
Oh.
Right. Some of us were members of this group that had the special training. We didn't know where we'd be at that time. We just figured that somewhere we'd be in England or Wales or France or whatever. And I remember that after the ship landed, and we'd set sort of a new speed record for getting across with something like 5.5 days or something like that for a huge ship. But at any rate, we had the women out there greeting us with donuts and coffee when we arrived in the morning, that kind of thing. And then right on the trains and down to Southern England, and there, the very night that we arrived, there was a tremendous bombing time in the very area where we were, and we were in a schoolhouse, and believe me, we're hugging the walls and so on indoors to avoid it. But they said it was a terribly heavy drain. But we were okay. We didn't have it. And then the next few days we were over in Wales. And that was my father's parents' home country. They were both... my grandparents were born in Wales, and I got, while I were there, got to see where they had lived and so on. So that's kind of a special, but it had nothing to do with the war. So that goes.
And when was that, Sheldon? When did you arrive in Scotland?
Okay, let me look at my what I have here. Let's see. I went to David's Island February 18th. By February 25th, we were on the Aquitania. And March 2nd, we took the train to Bristol, England. So February 20th, March 2nd, we landed. And
the year was 1944?
And this was 44.
44.
44, okay. Yeah, right. In March of 44.
So before D-Day.
Right, right. And then in April, we were in the in Wales, and we were moved up to England for a while, Cornwall, England. And then in May, we moved again to southern England. And then June 6th, all 44, was D-Day. And we were well aware of that from midnight on, because we heard all the planes going over and so on. We knew it was coming sometime. But that was June 6th, D-Day. And we were a few miles away, right across. But it wasn't our day to travel. In July, we moved to the Hedgerow area and so on.
So when you did go to mainland Europe, like by that time, were you already assigned to a specific duty when you got there?
No, even there, we weren't sure. We did not know. It was a little difficult. We thought we'd probably be back with armored force, but we had people from all over the place. Just happened to be put together.
Yeah.
And a number of us had been in this training program for that time and thought we'd be put to work in that respect. But they suddenly realized that they now had the armored divisions there. One of them was the 10th Armored, and General Patton had that one at his disposal, so to speak. And there were two others, and I think that the 5th Armored were number two, so there were two of them that I'd been with at one time. And then it turned out that the people suddenly realized that the tanks could not continue to operate without gasoline and oil and ammunition and the rest being with them. And so that's when we all got assigned to truck companies to handle that. It didn't make an awful lot of difference while they were kind of stuck until 25th of August, when they finally broke through and got to Paris, and then they were on the move. This it had taken that long. Two full months, actually, before they could really, really move. You could really say almost 3 months, because it was from June 6th, D-Day, and until August 25th. And then they became desperate, and we were all put into truck companies, and our mine got to be the 4267th QM, quartermaster, that is, truck company. And that was the heavy truck company. And there, I have pictures of it and so on here, too. That that was put to work with the others, and most of them had the smaller 6x6 trucks, and they could have a certain weight limit, but we were the heavy trucks and so on. I had never seen them before. Some of the men had, and so anyway, they got accustomed to them in a hurry. It took a long time to load them, but then they could carry a tremendous load. And so they began to leave the area, which is close to the places where we had entered France, and now began to go. So somebody had the wise idea of organizing the Red Ball Express. Now, the Red Ball language that the railroad people know means that it is a speedy freight train that has to be given way on railroads and so on. So they called it the Red Ball Express. This began to go. All of our ammunition, all of our oil, all of our gas was still close to where the troops had originally come in. And now we had to move it from that area to get as far ahead as we could to catch up with the tank operations. So the Red Ball became a circular thing, going across France as far as Chartres, which is still west of Paris, for a long time, just as they were getting underway. And then when they began to move beyond Paris, then they really had the big route. It was really about 700 miles at one point from beginning all the way to the end where they were trying to take the supplies to the armored force and then back on the other. No other vehicles were allowed on the expressway, but there were sometimes as many as 5,000 of them, I think, moving it somewhere along here. I have some information like that. But at any rate, you probably have another area I'm going to.
So what was your specific role in the Red Ball Express? You were a driver?
No, I was a first sergeant because they formed a company immediately. We had their, typically there would be small squads, and then four squads would make a platoon, and then four platoons would make a company of about 200 men. So that, and that would be at least, in most of them, about 20, 25 trucks altogether. But we would have a few less than that because these were so large. You had to have so many men to load them and so on. So that we operate with about 15 trucks at a time. That'd be the limit. And I think there were just a couple of other heavy truck companies with us doing just the same thing. But I know when I've read about this, we often hear that black people were given the first opportunity to do something that they really wanted to do in terms of military service. They really, really weren't involved with infantry or artillery or any of the others. But when it came to loading trucks and driving trucks and so on, then they were top-notch. We had no blacks in our company, and there weren't any in any other company as far as that goes. They just had they had white officers, but the blacks all had to stay in London, right? That wasn't changed, of course, until well after the war.
So you mean the company would be all black except for the officers? So with That's your right. company, it was white officers and white?
All white.
Everybody was?
All white. They had nothing to do with the heavy truck company.
Even though it was almost 75% African-American, the Red Ball Express, right? So did it feel very segregated?
Sure, yeah. We had the, we realized what was happening, but there's nothing you could do about it in those days. And finally people did do something, and that was it. And I think I have some books about it. The blacks were disturbed, but they realized that they were doing a real job, and that was the important part of it. And I think others began to realize it too, because everywhere they came, they were loading or unloading, and so that was just it. We're doing the job for you. That's it. Which is sad, but it's the way.